ready because we have to have an intervention. We have to have an intervention because of that.
We can't have it. That's our noise floor tester. If we didn't have Julius, we wouldn't be able to make sure that Terry's, you know, microphone was working.
This is and the now, first time I've seen the cat trying to get away.
And now suddenly Julius has realized that something has gone
terribly wrong.
This is not the love. I do not want this love.
We have to have an intervention about this cat. Because you're wearing this cat literally, and when the cat's not when you're not literally wearing the cat, you're figuratively wearing it from all the fur. I'm pretty sure that your white hair is mostly Julius at this point.
Would not be wrong.
I can't compete with that.
Well, look, that's the perfect screen cap right there.
So this is the YouTube shorts for the show. Got it. We'll get a thousand views just because of the cat. Oh, look, his internet crashed because he was so purry. I don't know what we're going to do about this show. Howdy, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Dead Robot Society. I'm Paul E. Cooley. Joining me today is Veronica Jaguar and Terry Mixon and special guest James J.C. Carpio. Thank you for joining us, James.
Apologies in advance, James, because, you know, we're just going to totally ruin this for you. This is what 600 to 700 episodes of podcasting will do to you right here.
Are you pointing at me or were you pointing at yourself via camera? What are you doing?
Whatever here? Makes you feel worst.
Well, I mean, is it time for your musical episode yet? Or are you
we need to have one. We were actually doing that last episode. We were bursting into song.
Oh, that was last episode.
Was it last episode?
No, it was the episode before that.
Maybe it was the one before that.
So that was the one where V did her After Dark voice.
$20 patron level. The vapors. Antoine will back me up. That's a $20 patron level, gosh darn.
Man, we will do anything for money. That just doesn't sound good. You should not stream that out, that statement I just made. I just thought about that. You should not stream that out. Anyway. So I can shut the hell up and stop making any more of a fool out of myself. We'll do our small talk BS, which is, V, how you doing? What's going on?
Hi, I'm here.
That's helpful.
That's very brief.
I'm busy running 16 different ways and still writing. But, oh, actually, really cool news. I got selected for the Audiobook Publishers Association. Wow.
Continue. Ignore chat. Fuck them. Right. Continue.
We'll have to talk about a $40 patron level later, and it'll probably come with
Well, Paul was talking about fishnet stockings and himself earlier, so I believe there are options.
Good to know. We'll make a note. Anyway, so I got into the Audiobook Publisher Association's, it's like twice a year they do this thing called Quick Pitch. And when it was in person, they called it speed dating, which essentially what it is they select like 20 narrators. And when it was in person, they would circulate around and talk to all of these different producers and casting directors. And then, you know, COVID and nobody wanted to be in person because the whole thing with the upper respiratory and people who talk for a living is probably not a good idea.
Yes.
So they've gone to doing it online, which means they can do it a little more conveniently and have more people and do it a little more often. But what that means is that in 2 weeks, I will be able to quickly and hopefully succinctly, because I'm going to practice and have a script, introduce myself to about 20 to 30 casting directors and publishers who I have not met before. So hopefully that will get me more work because people will be able to meet me and understand what I do. And dear God, I hope this doesn't like make them run screaming. So here's hoping.
What would this make? What?
I'm a mom. I don't look like I should be voicing like YA or, you know, whatever.
Nobody cares what you look like. It's radio. Plus you look fine. Cut it out.
Whatever. So sometimes I narrate for The Dark Magazine, which is a horror podcast. And they hadn't put out some podcast episodes for a while. I got one. It was the coolest. It's called House. It's a short story by T.J. Simfell. Written in the second person, which is hard as hell to do and have it come off really well. But it was deliciously creepy. And I think I did a good job on it. So when it goes live, I'll probably post it to Discord so people can hear it because it's free. But yeah, really good, really creepy. So yeah, that and running kids between school and bowling alleys and theaters, wrangling cats.
The usual.
My usual. How about y'all?
Terry.
I haven't done jack all when it comes to writing in the last week. Have not done a single word because I've been spending the week installing cat furniture and moving treadmills.
There are no like cat-sized treadmills, right?
The cat. No, this is a this is a human treadmill that I ordered that was delivered that I had to partially disassemble and move to the second floor of my house.
You know, if you threw a rock, you could probably hit the right teenager who would have done that for you for $50.
I called an author friend here, who you've met, Craig Smith, to come over and give me a hand moving it up the stairs. It's still partially disassembled because we haven't had the time frame to come get it back together, and it's a two-person job to get it put back together so that you don't drop the really expensive part on the top as you're trying to remount it back to the treadmill. That kind of thing. But I'm beat up. I'm tired. I spent yesterday, just took the day off and read a book, and I'm going to do the same today. So there. Well, actually, that's been today. I read last night. But I'm glad that that's over. There's a lot of cat trees, a lot of cat slings in the house now. And JR is sitting over there going, "Oh my God, I can't believe that Terry is doing all this cat furniture. He needs an intervention.
He does need a fucking intervention." I don't agree with JR Hanley ever. Well, I shouldn't say ever, but pretty damn close to ever. But he's right about this. You need an intervention. You've gone cat crazy.
Gone? Sure.
You've got like three cat lady, crazy cat lady
surrogates. I don't know why you would say anything like that when you look at my wall full of cat furniture.
I just think you're doing research for your cat parkour series. That'll happen, you know, in like parkour. 6 or 7 years.
You know what? You need to call the guys who made or the game company that made Stray and say, "Look at this shit. Put this shit in your game." He goes into the cat goes into a building that has nothing but cat furniture. That would be awesome. People who played Stray know what I'm talking about.
Julius approves. Dad, write some stories about me, Dad. Dad, I'm the main character. Look at me. As a handsome boy.
JR, don't make us ban you. Ban you. Good Lord.
Yeah, it took us 6 months last time to figure out how to get him back on and able to come into the chat.
I know. He's so obnoxious. Well, JC, what have you been up to?
I'm all over the place, especially in the past few months. I went back to school. Because I now work in higher education, and higher education demands that you have those pieces of paper that you spend lots of money on and spend lots of years. So, I mean, I got the job, but there was like this whole ordeal of like, well, if we give you a job here, then you're going to have to go get XYZ. So I swear to God, I plan to dip my degree in gold when I get it and wear it like a big Flava Flav thing around my neck with a chain just to kind of go... This is like, look, bitches, I got the degree.
Actually, what you should do is you can get it printed, like screen print it, and they'll make custom fabric and get yourself like either a onesie or do like the matching top and bottom tracksuit. But yeah, I, as someone who survived 15 years in higher education and is a recovering academic, yes, yes.
Recovering academic. I love that.
It's pretty crazy. I mean, I love working in academia because, believe it or not, away from the corporate lifestyle of like the bottom line of each quarter and stressing because you may not meet whatever goal you're supposed to meet. Higher education is more like, yeah, we got goals, but when they get done, they get done. So it's...
Your campus and my campus were very different.
I guess it depends on the campus. So, I mean, not that anyone's going to call up my boss and say, "Hey, he was on a podcast," but I work for Yale University. So, Yale is pretty big and pretty laid back, actually, for the most part. So, and really enjoying that. Outside of that, going to school to get a degree in IO psychology, which I know sounds really exciting.
Say that again?
You are a masochist, sir.
What kind of psychology?
I believe called... V knows something about psychology courses.
Yeah, I got my master's in teaching with a focus on 6th through 12th grade mathematics, and then I was working on my doctorate in science education, and the science I went for was psych, because since I did teaching and learning and study strategies, that made the most sense. Well, the program I was in, you pretty much did all of the classes for the clinical. You just didn't sit and actually have, you know, hours and evaluations like that. IO psych, we were pretty much told you can't even consider doing that part time because it is so intense. And you're playing the game on hard, sir.
Well, so the thing is, so in real life, I'm a learning and development specialist. So I actually write training for Yale and develop programs and everything. So instructional designer, they sometimes refer to it as.
I did that. Yes. Yes.
But IO psychology is
found
industrial / organizational psychology, which basically means it is the discipline of psychology where you go into a corporate office in HR and figure out who you want to fire because they don't fit right into the company. That's pretty much, long story short, is what IO psychology is. You shrink people to go, bye. So, or when they come in to hire them, you just learn, pick at them, you know, pick their brain to figure out, okay, this person's a psychopath, this person's lazy. All right, this person will fit in absolutely correctly. So that's kind of the degree I'm going for. And then lastly, for writing, so I am a role-playing game writer, which is probably a very, well, similar, but not very similar to the writing that you do. But game writing is interesting. I am actually working on a project right now that we're codenaming Witchlight, or Tools of Magic, which is basically simply chaos takes over the world. Gaia wakes up again and says, hey, what's going on? And imbues neo-pagans with the power to use magic, but they can't handle it very well. So they're kind of throwing it around and lighting things on fire because they're thinking that they're doing something.
Monkeys with technology.
Yeah. And then we just, so I work for two, well, I'm part of Solarian Games, which does Top Secret, or the newest version of Top Secret, which is a game from back in the 80s. And we just finished a module and did a Kickstarter. And module is basically like an adventure that you would, you know, the game master would buy and then run for his players. But, I've done a lot of freelance in the past, but right now that's my main project that, you know, things like today where I'm sitting writing a paper on North Korean and American trade practices kind of keeps me away. Oh, yeah, there's the game there. Top Secret New World Order.
Waiting for Terry's hand to fall off. He's been holding that thing for forever.
But that is my world, at least at the moment.
So you also wrote something for Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Yes.
There's a Humble Bundle out for like 75 adventures. Is yours among that?
No, because most of those adventures aren't the third-party adventures. So Goodman Games basically divides their categories into stuff we write and stuff that our third-party publishers write. So, and because they don't particularly own the IP, they can't particularly put that in the bundle. So... But DCC is basically one of the many what they call D&D clones, meaning that it's a game that's based off of D&D that was around back in the like late 70s to early 80s. And I really fell in love with the game and said, shoot, I'm going to write a supplement for it. So it took me a couple of years to write, but let me see if I can. I think it's here on my. Oh, here it is. Ugh. The Tales from the Fallen Empire, which is kind of a sword and sorcery, Conan meets Cthulhu meets every other thing I can think of. Actually, it is based on my favorite, well, it's inspired. I can't say based, even though a lot of stuff is stolen from it. There was a movie that Roger Corman did back in 1983 called The Warrior and the Sorceress with David Carradine. It was a movie full of, like, naked women.
That was Sword and the Sorcerer, monsters. Right? Sword and the Sorcerer?
Well, no. It was called The Warrior and the Sorcerer. Okay. Sorceress. And actually, if I can find the picture, one of the archetypes is definitely looks like David Carradine in that particular role. So anyway, but no, long story short, that was kind of a long way to say, no, it's not in the bundle, Terry, but yeah, it's a third party piece and they don't usually put third party pieces in.
Hmm. What about you, Paul? What have you been up to?
I'm making things extinct.
I hear you're about to blow up Kima.
You know, I told y'all that I was going to thinking about ditching some words, and y'all yelled at me and threatened to throw an intervention and all sorts of not nonsense. Well, I tossed all that shit in an old folder, and I started over from where it made sense to start over. And I've only got, 6,000 words to recover before I'm back to that 17 again that I ditched. And the book is so much better for it. So much better. But now I get to blow up everything I wanted to blow up because I figured out how to do it. So, yeah, your neck of the woods is not looking too good.
It all has it coming.
There were hellfire missiles fired and all sorts of shit's going on. People are all confused. Cell phones aren't working for some reason. The internet's down. People in Houston all freaking out.
I'm sure a nuke can fix that.
I'm having so much fun. So anyway, I'm in Battle 2. we'll get to that in a second. So I'm working on that and getting all that fixed up. And apart from that, just cleaning some things up here and there and trying to get all the podcasts caught up to date, which should be today. Anyway, that's what's been going on with me. Now you may show that obnoxious question for James about dice pools.
I was going to type it out, but so yes, actually I run the gambit. So I've designed stuff that's D20 based, kind of like D&D. A dice pool, actually Top Secret New World Order is a dice pool game that, because the one thing I hate about games is when you have to add numbers, because I'm horrible at math, which is weird for a game designer. So I usually try to design games that you just add extra dice in as modifiers instead of like adding plus one, plus two, because that gets really confusing and hurts my head. And I love dice pools. Like Shadowrun is one of my favorite and most hated games, but it's one of those games where you need like 40 D6s and you're just sitting there like doing this and then throwing them on the table and picking through to see which one's got five and six. But no, I've like I said, I've run the gambit on different types of game design. And like I said, mostly because I'm lazy and I try to find designs that encourage my laziness. So
so what I'm hearing is you designed the game more for convenience of the DM than you or the GM rather than the player.
That's a totally valid way to go this.
I'm not passing judgment. I simply asked the question. Is that essentially
what you're talking about? Leading tone. Uh-huh.
Well, actually I'll rephrase your comment and say it's more the convenience of me. Like honestly, it's just like I designed this game for myself and I'm glad other people like it, but
yeah, exactly. All right, my point's still valid, which is too general.
How do I balance the game? A flat surface. So for example, like I'll just give a quick thing on Top Secret, right? So Top Secret, we call the system Lucky 13 because basically that's the number you have to hit when you roll your dice in order to succeed. If you roll under, obviously you fail. So like that 13 is the balancer. And so remember, like I said, that you have scaling dice. So if you're really weak, you're going to roll d4s, which is going to make it really hard to get to a 13. But if you're really skilled in something, you might have a d12 or a d10 mixed into those numbers that will give you will give you, you know, the score that you're looking for. So it's just, so I like to balance things by die types, or if I'm going for something that's more D20-ish, there's a lot of stuff that was done in the fifth edition of D&D, like advantage and disadvantage, where you just roll two dice and take the higher, or roll two dice and take the lower. So it's those are just different ways of balancing in a more modern game design. Because if you look at if you look at original D&D, you have like, well, I have a plus one sword, and I have plus two armor, and I have a plus one cup that gives me another plus two bonus to protection rolls because
it's but Tuesday. I'm poisoned, so that's -5
and
on the first.
Don't forget, you have to adjust that for the THACO.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you match it against another number. Then you have to look at a chart that interacts with each other to find out where, like, it meets. And then then basically, yeah, you... So while that style of game is fun, I guess, it just... You have to basically have a whole chart. Yes, actually, Savage Worlds was an inspiration for that particular rule set. Yep. Oh God. The FASA, no, not FASA, Base Rip was the, which basically stood for like the levels of play, which was like fantastic, amazing, cosmic. I don't know. Anyway, to go down the list, but, yeah, it was, this actually was a very neat design for the time it came out, and they used it across several games. So it was still a chart and it was color coded. And you basically just rolled your dice. You found where your dice ended up on this color chart. And depending on where that color chart fell was kind of how well you did at the, you know, your roll. So it's fun. Actually, a lot of people started republishing with that system because the cool thing is you cannot copyright game design. So you can easily take someone else's game mechanics, change. So you can take D&D's game mechanics, strip off, you know, strength, dexterity, intelligence, charisma, put something else like might, smarts, you know, whatever, and publish it. And they can't, yeah, there is no rules on publishing game design, the mechanics. You just have to change names because, for example, like the D&D ones, which actually just became Creative Commons, by the way, because there's a whole kerfuffle with...
Don't get him started on Wizards of the Coast. Yeah, we don't have time for that.
Well, don't get any of us started on WotC. I'm not even a gamer, and I can't stand WotC.
I have way too many magic cards in my closet. Don't get me started.
Yeah, well, you did hear that Wizards of the Coast did send the Pinkertons after after someone. So what ended up happening is there's a YouTuber who does reviews of magic cards. By accident, they sent him basically a collection of cards that weren't going to be released yet and shouldn't have been that. And so they sent him, they realized they made the mistake. They kept trying to contact the person and they didn't get in touch with them. So they hired the Pinkertons to come to the guy's house and basically burst in with some fake pretense and take the cards. Yeah, they're Wizards of the Coast. Hooray.
Wow.
Damn.
Wow.
I didn't even think Pinkertons existed. I'm almost picturing like these horses pulling up outside this guy's house, you know, big brim hats.
Yeah, but you know what? The truth is I see that whenever I hear Federal Marshal as well. You know, it's always Marshal Dillon and fucking Dodge. It has nothing to do with anything else. I
think, you know, steampunk, but same thing. It's the bad guys who are gonna come and, you know, put a hood over your head and haul you off and beat you up. It's
pretty much.
So over magic cards.
Chris, I think your question may be better answered by Terry, who I think does lit RPGs. I mean, I have thought about it because it's really neat. It's basically like creating a create-your-own-adventure RPG, which is neat. But I've never had the pleasure of doing one. So, Terry, do you have any advice towards doing them?
I've written about 2/3 of a novel in lit RPG. I read lit RPG constantly, have for 4 or 5 years now, and I know that role-playing does benefit your ability to put the game mechanics into your writing because you have to do it in a way that makes sense but doesn't get in the way of telling the story. I'm not going to say that it's mandatory, but you'd have to read a lot of lit RPG to get the same level of experience you have playing a bunch of games.
I mean, yeah, just as because someone, you know one doesn't mean you know the other.
No. And as someone who hasn't played tabletop, but who has, you know, played other games where you've had to level up a character and choose stats to do, I can follow lit RPG pretty well, and I enjoy the heck out of it. But definitely, definitely understanding how to create or modify your, you know, standard game mechanics and then throwing a story on top of it. Oh yeah, that would be a definite asset.
William says RPGs are novels where you don't have to write a second draft.
Where things can end very badly for all of the characters involved.
I would say there's no first draft because like characters won't let it be a first draft.
Well, so the series that I helped co-write, it started out as RP. Essentially, you'd have the sequence of events, and then you'd have like chat logs and the battle logs. And then you take that, strip the timestamps off, and it would read like a, you know, like a play.
Right.
And then yeah. You'd go in and fill in all the details, and then you'd have a story. I mean, that was my intro to RPGs, was, you know, writing back and forth rather than, you know, throwing dice on the table.
Well, one of the industry things that's going on right now, and it's almost like a mini phenomenon, so I don't know how long it's going to last in, you know, the zeitgeist of RPGs, but a lot of companies have been publishing a lot more solo RPGs, and not only that, companies that publish like full-blown systems have actually written supplements now so you can play the game solo. Like, for example, the One Ring, which Terry was talking about mm-hmm. a couple of nights ago, actually has something called Strider Mode. It's an extra book that you can buy that tells you how to play that full role-playing game by yourself. And what it simply is it takes, it's all random charts and tables. So you go in and it'll, you know, you roll and find out what your scenario is, and you roll and find out who might be part of that thing. And then you just end up using the game mechanics to facilitate that story. So it's all just random rolls of dice to give you your plot, to give you your NPCs, to give you your situations and conflict. And then you just use the main book to do it. But so I know the One Ring, Call of Cthulhu.
The new Moria Kickstarter is going to have a solo mode as well.
Yeah. So it's this like weird thing where now, I'm going to say this in the sense of, generation. I feel it's a very generational thing. I feel it's like the younger player, like the Gen Zers, are either too lost in this, like I just need to be on my TikTok and by myself all the time, or it's more or less of like, oh no, COVID will eat me alive if I go out and game in person. Because even just recently, I read an article where they were complaining that there weren't enough game masters out there to run games, and that's why people play solo. So it's really weird because I've had groups since I was 16. So I don't want to go into how many years that is, but it's definitely a handful. And I've never had that problem where I'm sitting there going, oh gosh, I have no one to play with. You know, it's I can pretty much throw a rock and find a couple of people who'd be like, yeah, let's go and kill orcs, or let's go and, you know, shoot up a plaza or something. Well, that sounds bad. But
yeah, that sounds real bad.
Cyberpunk plaza, a futuristic plaza with neon, and
you want to go visit Nakatomi Plaza. Just admit it.
Doesn't everybody want to go to Nakatomi Plaza? JR asks, what do you think about the use of AI in game design as has recently come up with Wizards of the Coast?
All right. So two minds of that. So first I'm going to say that I am a user of ChatGPT. I don't use it for my game, so I'll say that straight up, however, I've thrown in situations like, write me a module, actually, it was really cool, too, I said, write me a module where the main villain is a heavy metal lord who takes over a village and does blah, blah, blah. It actually spit out a three-part adventure, and it was pretty amazing, like, the villains it created in basically AI were, like, big gorilla-bodied things with speaker heads that we use sonic attacks. So, and you can then tell ChatGPT to stat out the monsters, and it does it. So it can write. However, it's a much, and you would have to edit it down anyway. So I just like writing my own. However, the big sticking point is, which I agree with, is using AI art.
Sonorillas.
Sonogorillas.
Sonogorillas and Sonorillas. That's awesome.
But AI art is, if you know how to do the prompts right on something like Midjourney, or there's another one I can't stand. I think it's like DALL-E or something like that, which is kind of lame. But Midjourney is amazing. And now that it's in its fourth or fifth iteration, where it actually gives you the regular amount of fingers on your hand, because that was a problem
sometimes
with the last iteration. Yeah. But it does beautiful artwork. And if you're basically know how to do the prompts, you can recreate all, black and white. I've done some that look like, Savage Sword of Conan artwork, black and white artwork from the 70s. And I think the biggest tension point, and then I'll shut up after it, is that people think that it's stolen art. But if you think about it, any artist is going to go and look at other art and be inspired by it and say, I really like the way that line is drawn, or I really like the way they do faces, or and they're going to take that and incorporate it into their own art piece. So that's all AI is doing, is AI is going through.
No. No, okay. Totally fucking disagree.
Okay. I'll just throw this in here as my thought on that. It's a machine. It can't be inspired.
Yeah.
With a human being, you might say something, say, oh, that's beautiful, and you are inspired by it. With a machine, it goes, I think this piece that I stole from this other place would work good here, so I'll stick it there.
Just remember, they train all that shit on. It came up with Getty Images half the time with their watermarks. I thieved everything.
So and you're not going to find a very AI-friendly audience here.
Okay, you're not. Okay. You're going to find a very antagonistic one.
James and I see eye to eye on a lot of things. AI is one of those places where we don't.
But here's the thing, though. I won't use something like Midjourney to publish with. Like that, no, I won't do that. However, if I'm doing something like, sometimes I just need inspirational art. Like if I'm writing and I'll imagine something, I go, I wonder what that would look like if it was rendered. Instead of me doing my weird malformed artwork, I'd rather have like it spit out something that looks like an illustration and go, all right, cool. That, so that's it. For RPGs, I'll use AI for inspiration, but I won't use the writing or artwork for the publish.
I love that, Matt. AI art is inspired in the same way that drops of rain are inspired to form puddles. Too many software developers in this chat, trust me.
Fade to black.
No, I think that there are use cases for it. And I came, I've done robotics and everything else. Obviously, I'm a proponent of machine learning and the LLMs. Sure. Show me your work. Show me where you got everything you trained it on, and then we'll talk.
So I've heard that small language models are now something that's coming up on the horizon rather than large language models. Is that something I could take my 40 some odd books that I've written and plug all my own work in and have it write my book?
I don't think you would have enough material to do that reliably. I don't think it's a large enough data set. Because I thought about that too, about whether or not you could take all of your books, all of your own artwork or whatever, and shove it in there and have it learn on that. First thing I would do is unplug it from the network before I did that. But after doing that, it would be interesting to see what it would come up with.
Because if you're using only your own words and your own stories as the material that it's culling from, is it theft at that point? I suspect it's not.
If you're using your own work, that is completely different. But still, you won't be able to copyright it.
It's true.
Oh, that's, yeah.
So, I mean, that's the biggest downfall. Honestly, JR, I don't know what the minimum word count would be needed, but I mean, Matt will have to back me up on this, but it's usually orders of magnitude of data that it needs to do stuff, unless they've somehow changed it.
So you wouldn't be able to do it with, say, Shakespeare?
You Shakespeare might have enough data to at least do something.
I don't know. Shakespeare is still, word count wise, is less than what my novels are.
But it's a play. So it's a completely different animal. That would be very difficult, I think, for an AI to do, because it would have to create things for stage directions. Yeah.
Yes, I am the one who keeps the complete works of Shakespeare right under her desk for easy reference.
Yeah, Tim says Yuda did something with relatively small language models for AI poetry before this current generative trend began. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, two of them writing poetry, I think. Yeah. Damn it. For an AI, small is relative, and you get what is called overfitting data. You may be able to train it on your work, but it wouldn't have enough variety to come up with anything new. Right. You got to have a lot of data. Now, if you were to take everybody who works for Variant or somebody like that who has, you know, they've got 100, 200 books in their catalog, that may be a little bit different.
This may be true, but can you imagine trying to mix different things together? Can you imagine me and Colonel Brazzi mixing his hardcore military science fiction and my space opera together? There's no telling what would come out of that.
What the fuck do you think these people are doing by giving these prompts? It's just mashing shit together. It's syntactic calculus. It has absolutely fucking nothing to do with creativity. It just steals it and throws it together.
You see, James, we've hit a hot spot.
Well, at least it's not me ranting, so that's a positive.
Yeah, I'll go after the quote unquote AI. You go after WotC, and we'll have our own goddamn show. That's how we'll do shit. I think there are uses for it. Yeah, exactly. Like I said, there's use cases for it. Antoine asks, "You're telling me that Brandon Sanderson hasn't written enough tomes to make AI work?"
Probably not. I mean.
He's written a lot of words.
Brett says, "I'm so going to ask ChatGPT to marry Twilight, one of Terry's space operas." If it answers back that it knows the synopsis of his books.
Why is Admiral Mertz so sparkly?
Why is Ensign So-and-So so furry today? Yeah,
that's a totally different story right there. Rule 34.
Meanwhile, one of them has six fingers, the other one three, and one has one toe.
And, you know, the next intersystem conflict breaks out because one is Team Jacob and one is Team Edward.
Oh, God, that actually is perfect. Why aren't you writing this shit? Total satire. Be awesome.
I'm too busy writing other stuff.
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to her. I know we can't get you to do anything.
Still working through, you know, my pitched and tweaked story. I'm halfway through.
Jared says, "I'm convinced that Chuck Tingle was written by an AI. Aren't we all?"
You know, I recently just, because there is a Chuck Tingle RPG on Amazon if you dig deep enough to find it. And the cover's horrendous. But I was trying to read it, and it was kind of like, it was like, I don't. It was like a mishmash of the way it described what sort of stuff it was. I'm just sitting there going, "How can you mix like Harry Potter, gay erotica, and like all these other things?"
Big wad you have, yeah.
Clearly, you have never read like 19, 20 year olds writing fan fiction.
Honey, I want to see your Horcrux.
Harry Potter slash fic. Here we come.
You don't even want to know what the Dementors are wearing. You just don't even want to know.
What do they have under those robes?
It's more on lines of what's attached to where.
There's nothing.
Yeah, the Tingleverse. The Tingleverse, which I don't even want to go there because the Tingleverse just brings up too many images in my head.
There are so many things on that topic I'm ignorant of. I don't know really anything about him other than by reputation and memes. That's about it.
All right, now, Tim says Harry Potter slash fic is a dime a dozen. Oh, so yeah. Slash fic is male. What is the term? Isn't it? Is what? Are you, what will you do if it's Hermione slash fic? How would that
no,
work?
No, I mean you.
Slash fic doesn't have to be homosexual.
No, I thought slash fic was male.
Because I've seen slash fic where it was Kirk and Spock having an affair, and then there was one where Batman and Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent were having an affair. So yeah, I didn't read them. Okay. I just know of them.
Our definition from Oxford Languages.
Oh shit. Is
a genre of fiction published chiefly in fanzines or online, in which characters who appear together in movies, television, or other popular media are portrayed as having a sexual, especially gay, relationship.
So it doesn't have to be gay.
No, it does not. The example is this year's sleeper hit is a faithful screen adaptation of Star Trek / fiction.
Okay. Rick says, in the voice.
In the voice. Hey, that was a preview of your $20.
That was just a teaser for the After Dark, if you know what I'm saying.
I know. I wonder if that adaptation was the Janeway 7 of 9 / fiction.
Wait, the whole
you know
Janeway
it
what?
Was out there. You know it was out there.
I didn't hear the whole the show.
Thing. Janeway and who?
7 of 9.
Oh, ooh, yeah.
No, you should go. If you're going to go that way, it's going to be Janeway and B'Elanna Torres. If you're going to go that way, you know, you got to bring in a Klingon in here.
No. That would have been B'Elanna, Paris, and Kim.
Yeah, because honestly, with Janeway and 7 and 9, I think you would have like a serious DS relationship going there. Like, definitely. Absolutely.
Now, you can't have Harry Kim in that because that guy never gets anything. He doesn't get promoted. He doesn't get any command of anything. He can't possibly have sex. He's a virgin.
Rick says he's so wearing his biker Voyager leathers to go with your corset.
Voyager. First of all, I have two, so you'll have to pick. And secondly, I got one for Christmas. Yay.
Are those the dyed pink leathers? Or the bright yellow ones. Which ones are you wearing, Rick?
They're not the construction cone orange ones?
Brett says, I think Batman Robin / fiction is simply making subtext text.
You know what?
Although it depends on Robin.
There was a cartoon that was on for a while that I thought was pretty hilarious. A little subgenre thing called the ambiguously gay duo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
On SNL, yeah. That was just ridiculous. Just so bad. You only wear black. I don't think that's true. I have seen you in Vegas. Or were you talking about you only wear black in the After Dark kind of places?
Yeah, well, he's not mentioning whether he's wearing with the tassels.
Or chaps. Assless chaps. Because assless chaps, you know.
Mm. Or both.
Yeah.
You could technically have assless chaps with tassels. Just tassel placement.
But the furry tail is going way too far. Anyway, so maybe not far enough. There was a topic here that we were on, and I have now completely...
We got dragged into the gutter. We need to find a way back out again.
I just sat here as a bystander and watched you guys drag this show down into a train wreck.
We were talking slash fic, and then that went down.
And that came from the Chuck Tingle bit.
Oh, right, Chuck Tingle.
Right.
I'm absolutely terrified. There's no escape from the gutter. Yeah, I believe it. I believe it.
Just sit down, splash around a bit. You'll be fine.
Shut up, William. We're not going to ask ChatGPT how to get out of the gutter. I don't want to know what it's going to say. I just don't want to know.
But while we're still in the gutter, I will mention, though, that because before the show, we're talking about some of the things that I've done. And I have written for the Gore RPG, so John Norman's Gore. And I said so Gore is basically, imagine really bad BDSM pulp space fantasy. That's the best way to explain Gore. He has something like 42 books.
Oh my God.
I'm not surprised.
42 books in the Chronicles of Gore. And he's been writing them since the late 70s. But... Anyway, they made a role-playing game out of it, and I ended up writing a module for it. And as I was explaining, it was a really weird balance of trying to write BDSM erotica with, like, science fantasy. So it was a really interesting, especially when you're trying to get in the head of some of the minor characters. Like, one was a slave, so trying to, like, get into that idea of how this submissive would like run around and support the group, which made no sense since everyone else were these big burly barbarian men with big spears and swords. And, you know, and actually the slaves had to travel in cages. I don't know. It just goes down so many rabbit holes that I won't get into it, but it was very weird writing.
So that particular genre subset, wow, it is a subset of game lit and lit RPG. It is marketed, so it can be, it's lit RPG or game lit, but if it is not harem, which they don't really want to call it harem or reverse harem anymore. If you have a female protagonist and multiple male protagonists, I apologize for the binary, but that's the easiest way to explain it. Then it's considered why choose, and that's like the better, that's the more appropriate way, but it's reverse harem.
Called what?
Why choose? Why
as
choose?
In chromosome twos?
No, as in no, why like make a why, choice W-H-Y. Between take yeah. it all, take
oh,
it all.
Oh, yeah. Why,
I
why
like,
choose?
I
oh,
you right, said all right, all right. Mandarin or something. Like, it's called why choose?
I just thought it was chromosome no. times two. I don't know what the fuck is going on here.
So, but the flip, what your more traditional harem is actually called men's fantasy.
Men's fantasy?
Yes.
It's like men's action adventure with
pretty much where you've got like the one main male character and his entire team is made up of
We're talking Charlie's Angels kind of shit here or what?
No, none of them are ever as svelte as Charlie's Angels. Charlie's Angels would have fallen like face first for the weight. There is some honest goodness, anti-gravity frontal stuff going on with half of these characters.
Whoa! Well,
now, Hollywood... mind you, I've narrated a handful of reverse harem or why choose, and it's interesting. I've narrated a couple more. See, you said that clicked in my head. Gore, G-O-R. I thought it was G-O-R-E, and I'm like, oh, this is like some horror splatter fic. Nope. That brain tracked back. But the men's fantasy, the more traditional harem stuff, lit RPG, I've narrated a handful of those. And it's interesting because the more recent stuff that's been written in like the last 10 years has a really, it's more balanced than you think it would be. And I say this as someone, you know, I have opinions. They come out a lot.
I wanted to just say quickly, so you were mentioning talking about Charlie's Angels. So there was actually official terminology that was called jiggle shows.
What?
Like Charlie's Angels, Three's Company. They were referred to as jiggle shows.
No.
Yes, they were.
This makes sense.
No.
Yeah, because I did some research on a book I was writing a supplement I was writing a while back on like blaxploitation and like 70s grindhouse movies. And that was one of the interesting things I learned was that those shows, Charlie's Angels, Three's Company, at the time were referred to as jiggle shows because you watched them because they had heavy-chested women dance jumping around on
no the comment screen. Absolutely no comment.
This is so the thing you choose to not have a comment about.
What was I 11
this, after everything else that we have had, this is the one you're going to take a stand on.
I'm just saying,
just what we'll, and we'll note that Golden Girls is not part of that genre. Well,
was,
I don't know,
kind of jiggle, that was a completely different kind of jiggle. That was more of a swing.
I mean, if we're talking demographics right now versus then, I mean, those...
Men get floppy, women get droopy. That's just the way it works.
Okay.
So you're saying that's the floopy genre.
I'm saying y'all shouldn't be making fun because I'm pretty sure that Betty White and Rue McClanahan and B. Arthur were in their mid-50s. So...
They were wonderful, wonderful actors.
They were fantastic.
They were fantastic.
And she was smoking when she was young.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, most of them were.
B. Arthur would cut a bitch. I mean, that would be...
Maud? No, really? I remember my 70s barely, but I remember them. So I remember all that horse shit.
I don't. My 70s consisted of
being born.
I only had like 18 months of the 70s, and I think it was probably Star Trek reruns and The Muppet Show. That's what I remember. And Sesame Street.
JR says he watched.
But my parents are weird.
JR says he watches Baywatch for the swimming lessons. Mm-hmm. That's like reading Penthouse for the articles.
And JR, B. Arthur, was a Marine.
Hmm. She was a driver, wasn't she?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say that B. Arthur was on Baywatch. I was just like, oh my God, that would have been like...
I missed that. That would have been fucking
epic, man. She and Phyllis Diller, hook those two up, put them out there on Baywatch. That'd be some funny-ass shit, man. I'd have paid money for that.
Sitting on the beach in Moo's yelling at Baywatch.
Film them running down in the slow motion down the beach.
Oh my God, without bras.
Oh,
that's more like slap your forehead TV, not jiggle TV.
Stop laughing. Concussions are a real thing.
I'm sorry. Oh my God. Lies that many of us read Playboy for the articles and short stories. Actually, their short stories were great because they paid really well. Back in the day, I think you could get like, I don't know, it was like $5,000 to $10,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah, back in the day.
I don't know that it was ever that much, but it was good money.
It was good money.
Well, did Penthouse pay? Because I remember Penthouse forums were really popular back then, too.
They don't pay.
They don't, not for that, no.
No.
But Playboy for short stories, they paid a lot.
They touted themselves as completely, not subscriber, but audience fueled. Mm-hmm.
Continue laughing, Paul. The energy fuels the dark magic. What is going on with this dark magic horse shit? Have you got like your GRS Ouija board? What's going on? I am suddenly feeling
that to us or to Terry's cats, because if anything is going to like maintain a cursed circle, it's going to be the cats behind Terry.
I could just see Terry's cats back there, like, you know, just slowly wandering around in a circle, meowing in strange tongues, whatever that sounds like. That's violent, not Matt. How can you possibly have lived your life and not known who B. Arthur is? My God, get cultured, you UK schmuck. What the hell's wrong with you? Teen theater writer needs an exorcism. Yes, I believe that.
She was actually even in the Star Wars Christmas special.
Why would you bring that thing up? Why? This is a family show, man. Why would you bring up that fucking vile horror wreck? My God.
Slash Fiction is just fine, but when we start bringing up this Christmas
that's
show...
That's going too far, baby. Too far. That's going to get us banned and canceled right there. You know, kind of like the careers of everybody who's in it.
It was like Harvey Korman was in it, B. Arthur.
Oh, God, are you serious?
Now I'm going to look this up.
I blocked that out because I think I watched like 2 minutes of it when and was like, this is shit. And that was back when I was young. Brett wouldn't know. She was the cantina owner.
Oh, yeah, and you also get Harvey Korman in drag. In the Christmas special.
What?
He plays a six-armed chef. I know, sorry.
I got nothing. I just got nothing. I just see the chef from Futurama now. What was his name? Oh, fuck. He's supposed to be making fun of Emeril, and I can't remember his name. Brett says he has the special on DVD and watches it every year. Why is it so easy for me to believe that? Why is it so easy for me to believe that? Good God.
I'm reading the cast list on IMDb for this, and
it's terrifying, isn't it?
I'm dying a little inside every single day. Just
remember, it was work.
I've used that line before.
One of the best reasons to watch it is you get to see both Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill so coked out of their minds that they're just priceless. Like, Carrie Fisher was on several different things
with
the filming of that episode. It's
might have been the only way she got through it. Jeez.
Yeah, it was pretty shitty. I'd have had to have been high as a kite to do that crap, too, and going, wow, I'm making this really shitty TV thing that's going to kill my career. Yay! An offer rate! Yay! Or what's they call it? Scale? And there you go.
And yet one of the pictures that's on IMDb, like one of the first ones, is Bea Arthur, and she's standing there, and there are a bunch of, like, Greedos behind her, for crying out loud, or someone who looks like
an army of Greedos behind Princess Arthur.
and she's standing there, and she still looks like a badass. It's like, that's right, I'm going to take this role, I'm going to shove it down your throat.
I'm so glad I never watched this hunk of shit, so I can't have horrible flashbacks, because wow. It gets more terrifying by the sound of it. Mm-hmm. Matt says, look at the list of musicians in the Blues Brothers film sometime. Now that is some list of names to drop. Yes, it is. It's amazing.
Yeah, if you watch Blues Brothers 2000, which is a ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous sequel, but the soundtrack is amazing. I mean, they have Johnny Lang on there, like, so good. Don't watch, just go listen to the soundtrack. Don't bother watching the movie. Although the last, like, 10 minutes where they have, like, the big old review in the bayou and Erica Buddy was watching down on everybody, that's pretty good.
I have no idea what she's talking about.
It was a musical. You wouldn't have watched it.
You're right. I would not have watched it.
We were going to go ahead and talk to James about what goes into RPG design, and it just didn't happen. So we're going to go ahead and do that in the after show. So
we're actually going to have a topic in the after show that doesn't support that stuff.
I know. So if anybody that's not a patron and wants to hear about that, you'll have to go ahead and drop a buck and buy me a coffee so you can get access.
Oh, no. Question, what other films are totally outclassed by their soundtracks?
Heavy metal.
Yes.
Cocktail.
Oh, definitely Cocktail. As much as I loathe a lot of that music, definitely Cocktail. Sorry, I have guilty pleasures, and then I have what the fuck? Why am I being subjected to this pop radio bullshit moment?
Now, I don't know that the soundtrack outclasses the movie, but I wasn't allowed to see Rocky Horror Picture Show when I was a teenager, but somebody gave me the soundtrack on an LP. So I knew the music long before I ever actually saw the movie.
Mm.
No, it's... I think you. That's one you definitely have to have the movie with the context of the music. But to be fair, I used to only watch it all the way up until Meatloaf got killed in the freezer, because I was watching it for Meatloaf. And I was like, okay, best song is done. Now I go.
This is really funny. Chad has started a war over best soundtracks, which is funny.
Man of Steel?
He's actually true. JR says... that I lie. I started with soundtracks. I actually did have an 8-track player built into my stereo in my room. I came in at the very end of the 8-track being a valid medium in which to get music.
I did, and I grew up with that horse shit, and that died before I got a chance to really get embroiled in it. Sounds like you were embroiled in it.
Oh, only a little bit.
God, those things
we had
horrible.
Albums on the, you know, the big, like the big tape reels, and you'd put them on.
Really
reels,
yeah.
Yeah, oh, wow. We had those.
It's excellent quality, but it's not stretched up and everything
I think my parents had the Beach Boys' Greatest Hits in every possible format.
Format, yeah.
Yeah, also Jim Croce.
Oh, yeah. I like Jim Croce.
What else?
All right, Tim says, I'm only referring to mediocre bad movies with good soundtrack. Like, I love bad movies, so it's kind of hard for me to judge. So if I'm sitting here going, "Oh my god, the Star Wars Christmas special," it's
but it's got a banging soundtrack. I love when the Wookiees get down to disco for a while.
Actually, Donna Summer does a song on the Christmas special.
You're really killing everything. Just stop, okay? You're knifing my childhood to death.
All right, now we're going to have to go ahead and ban JR again, because here we go.
He says Rocky Horror is a crappy movie.
I will say it depends on the version that you watch, but the original...
If you see it live, it's a completely different animal. Yeah. That's where it shines and makes sense. Otherwise, yes, it is a ridiculous story. Absolutely ridiculous. But it's supposed to be. But if you have a comment about the show, you can send an email to show@deadrobotsociety.com. You can find me on Mastodon at paul_e_cooley at vyrse.social. You can find us on Facebook, the listeners of the Dead Robot Society Facebook group, where Terry mangles all the madness. You can find us on YouTube at youtube.com/DRS podcast, where we live stream every Saturday at 3 p.m. CST. And you're guaranteed to see cats. If nothing else, you will see cats. Too damn many cats. And if you want to support the show, you can find us at patreon.com/DRS podcast and buymeacoffee.com/DRS podcast, where for as little as $1 a month, you get access to exclusive live shows like the DRS After Dark we're about to do in a few moments. 10 minutes, as a matter of fact. So, you know, get ready for that. And at the $10 level, you get your name read. And our $10 patrons are Tony L. Joy, Isabel Cushy, and Tim Niederreiter. Thank you to all of our patrons for making this show possible. And with that, I think we're out of here.
We are out of here.
We are out of here. We have not forgotten anything.
We have not forgotten a single thing.
Okay, just check it. Well, everybody go. Well, I'll put links in the show notes for JC's info, and we'll get that out there. Where else can we find you, sir?
Well, you can find me on my YouTube channel with an interesting name called Show Us Your Crits, where we host the Welcome to the Grindhouse podcast/vidcast. And Twitter, I can be found at Grindhouse Media, which is GRINDHAUS. MEDIA. So,
wow, how artistic of you.
Yeah, I know. Great film house.
Well, that we are getting the hell out of here. Enjoy your Saturday. Thanks for spending an hour with us and wasting so much of your time. Hope you learned something great. Go check out JC's work, and we will see you next week. Same time, same channel. We're like a bad penny, or actually, we're more like herpes, I think.